hand, for I will not leave thee until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of. And Jacob awakened out of his sleep and said, Surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not. And he was afraid and said, How awesome or how dreadful is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. Now I want you to remember that particular phrase that he makes there. He says, This is the house of God, this is the gate of heaven. In other words, this is a place where God has demonstrated himself. It's a place where I have met him. As you read down through the remainder of the verses, it says that he built a pillar, or made a pillar, and poured oil on top of it. And in verse 19, he calls the name of that place Beth El, which means the house of God. The word El is God, and Beth is house, the house of God. And in verse 20, let's read that verse. Jacob vowed a vow, saying, If God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and a remnant to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. And as we study that passage, we recognize that here is a man who has been exposed to Christianity, or exposed to worship of Yahweh, we would say at this point. He has been exposed to truth, he's been exposed to a lot of Bible knowledge. But here's a man who is really struggling with his spiritual life. He's a man that you would look at and say that he is not sold out to the Lord. He has not come to where the rubber meets the road. He has a lot of head knowledge, but it is not something that he has put into practical application. He's willing to deceive. He's willing to do things his own way. He's willing to make things work the way that he has always done in his early life. And what we have here in verse 28 is an encounter with God, where God confronted him. And let me liken that to him being in perhaps a revival meeting. And he's heard truth, but in this particular revival meeting, a preacher brings forth a message, and as you sit there in a service, the Holy Spirit just really works on your heart. And while he's working on your heart, you know there are some things that you need to surrender to the Lord, some things that you need to deal with. And so at the end of the service, you have evidence and you know God is really dealing with you. And so you do as you ought to do. You respond in that service, and perhaps you bow here at the front and you talk to the Lord about that. And you get up and you tell people, God has just really worked in my life and there's some things that I need to deal with. You know, that is a great event. But really what is telling is if we were to come back to you in a week or a month or a year and say, okay, you remember that decision that you made, how's it going? How are you doing with that decision? Because there are numerous times where I included have come to a place where God is really working on me about some particular thing. And you may sit there and say, God is really dealing with me about a decision that I need to make. And you yield to the Lord. But then afterward, over the course of time, you kind of forget that. And you go your own way. We have in Jacob the opportunity to look at this and say, all right, how much difference did this, what we'll call simply a Beth-El experience for him, and I don't like to use the word experience because that's pretty touchy-feely, but that's what it was. He came to a place where God really had backed him up and gotten hold of him. And now God is going to send him through some fires and some trials, and he's going to have to see what happens. In chapter 29, God continues to lead this man. He goes to the right well. He finds the right girl. He ends up with the right family. He gets deceived by his uncle Laban. Let's turn over then to chapter 30, verse 27, and a verse again that we've already passed in our study of this particular passage of Scripture. But this is after he has had his 11 sons, and now he is looking at his father-in-law and saying, it's time for me to go away to my own country and to my own people, and give me my wives and let me go, and I've served you and everything is finished from our agreement. In verse 27, Laban responds to him and says, I pray thee, if I have found favor in thine eyes, or if I please you, tarry. For I have learned by experience that the Lord hath blessed me for thy sake. Now, if it were simply up to Jacob with what Laban said, if I find pleasure in your eyes, why don't you stay? Because Jacob would have said, you haven't, I'm leaving. But apparently he had some reason to make this agreement with his father. And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that he just didn't have things in order to leave yet. But what's interesting is the statement that Laban makes in this when he says, you know, I can see clear evidence of God's work in your life. I can see that God is doing something in you. You're not dormant at all. And God has blessed me because you're around. I can see how God is working. You move to the end of that chapter, and in verse 43 it says, the man increased exceedingly, or he exceedingly prospered and had much cattle and maidservants and men servants and camels and donkeys. This guy ended up, over the course of the next 6 years, really doing well financially. God had blessed him. And so it is evident that God has poured out his blessing upon this man. And when you come to chapter 31 then, it says that he heard the words of Laban's sons, saying, Jacob hath taken away all that was our father's, and that which was our father's hath he gotten all his glory or all his wealth. And Jacob beheld the countenance of Laban, and behold, it was not toward him as before. And the Lord said unto Jacob, return unto the land of thy fathers and to thy relatives, and I will be with thee. Now, here is the premise, or here is the statement that we're working off of tonight. That as we study Jacob's life, we realize that he recognized and acknowledged God's hand upon him. I don't think any of us here would look at the situations of life and say that God is not in them. I think all of us recognize the omniscience, the omnipotence, the omnipresence of God, and we know that God is working in our lives. We're the stubborn ones, and sometimes because of our stubbornness, God doesn't accomplish the things that he would like to accomplish in us. And Jacob had been through 20 years of learning, and in those 20 years of learning, he had come to a place where he had sensed that God was still doing some really good things in him. But I want you to see from this point on how Jacob does not just assume that people will understand that God is in this, but we have from the testimony of Jacob's own lips how he has been viewing the last 20 years. We have him giving testimony to three groups of people or three individuals that is going to tell us how he was addressing these things or how he was looking at these things. And the fact that God was very involved in what was taking place over those 20 years. Let's go to chapter 31 again and let's pick the story up in verse 7. After Jacob has realized that his brothers-in-law are against him and his father-in-law's attitude has changed toward him, he calls his wives, Leah and Rachel, and asks them to come out to the field and talk with him. In verse 7, here's what he says to his father, or to his wives. Excuse me. And your father hath deceived me, or he's cheated me, and changed my wages 10 times. But God suffered him not to hurt me. There's the first statement that I'll point out to you. While he's talking to Rachel and Leah, he says, you guys know that your father has changed my wages 10 times, but during all of this time, and he's particularly meaning those 6 years, he says, during those 6 years, you have seen evidence that God did not allow him to hurt me. Who's he giving the credit to? To God. I believe there's a lot to that. Let's go on down and I'll tell you what I mean by that. In verse 8 it says, if he said thus, the speckled shall be thy wages, then all the cattle bear speckled. And if he said thus, the ring staked or the stripe shall be thy hire, then bear all the cattle ring staked. Thus God hath taken away the cattle of your father and hath given them to me. Well, here's an interesting statement. He says, you know, you guys can see that God was doing something during these past 6 years. Keep going. In verse 11, and the angel of God spake unto me in a dream, saying, Jacob, and I said, here am I. And he said, lift up now thine eyes, and see all the rams which leap upon the cattle are ring-staked, speckled, and grizzled, for I have seen all that Laban doeth to thee. I am the God of Bethel, where thou anointest the pillar, and where thou vowedst a vow unto me. Now arise, get thee out from this land and return unto the land of thy kindred. Well, in verse 13, I asked you the question a minute ago. When somebody makes a decision and God really speaks to them, the question is, a week or a month or a year later, is this something that you're still holding true to? You know, I remember when I was a teenager and my dad did not go to church until we were older teenagers. And so I remember going to the Bill Rice Ranch and I remember Pete Rice preaching a message on rebellion. And at the end of that message, I went forward and I dedicated my life to the Lord. My pastor, Fred Barber, took the Bible and showed me Romans 12, 1 and 2, and I dedicated my life to the Lord. And when I dedicated my life to the Lord, that was something that I did that was a perpetual thing. Now, you have to maintain that dedication. But the question would not be, what was the decision I made at the front of the auditorium at the Bill Rice Ranch? The question would be, how has that impacted my life 20 years down the road? And it did. It impacted my life. And here is Jacob now, 20 years after this decision. He has not turned his back on God and said, oh yeah, that vow thing that I did at Bethel 20 years ago. This is 20 years later. God has put him through a university of instruction where he learns that his deceit is not the best way to treat things, not the best way to deal with things. And he looks at his family members and he says, to my family members, I want to say this to you. God did not let Laban hurt me. I want to say as well to you, in verse 9, God has taken away his cattle and given them to me. I want to tell you as well that that God has spoken unto me, and when I listened to him, he said, I want you to understand, the end of verse 12, I have seen all that Laban does to you. I've seen that. I've observed it. And what's amazing about this is that it would seem that this very passage is the one that tells us that Jacob had finally learned that there are some things that are not in his control, that he has to lean on God. You remember on Wednesday night we looked at the whole situation where Jacob takes the sticks and he pulls the bark off, and so you've got the stripes and you've got all this, and we are trying to figure out, you know, did he know something that we don't know? I don't know. I mean, had the shepherds learned something about genetics or breeding that we just do not know, we've lost because we're not out in the fields with the sheep all the time and we don't know something? That is very possible. But you know, I lean toward it is not what he had learned. I think God taught him something different in that time. Now, I can't be dogmatic on that. I think Jacob had fallen prey to perhaps a wives' tale or some pattern that they had fallen into and some belief he had. And so he starts and using this technique, and it works at first. But then his father-in-law changes and said, well, you know what? Since all the offspring are coming out striped, I want to take all the striped ones. Well, now what are you going to do? And he doesn't have anything to do spotted ones or not spotted ones. What do you put in front of them to make them have those? And over the course of those 6 years, as Laban changed his wages 10 times, I think Jacob had to come to the place where he said, you know what, I'm not going to put anything in the troughs where these sheep come to breed because I don't know what to put there. I don't know what Laban's going to change it to. And so after they've already bred, and then he decides after they've bred that he's going to take all the striped ones, and I put the striped magic sticks in there, and now they're going to have striped ones, and I'm going to lose them. I think he came to the place where he realized, I don't have to do that. I can simply trust God. I can let God take care of this, and if I let God take care of this, then you know what's going to happen? God is going to look at me and say, I've seen what Laban does to you, and I'm going to take what he has, and I'm going to give it to you. I'm going to say that God suffered him not to hurt me. And here's his first testimony. And sometimes the most difficult place to have a godly testimony is the place where you live. It's your home. It is where you stand up and say, God is doing something in my life. God is working here. And Jacob, the very first group that we see him giving a testimony to is his immediate family. He calls his family together and he says, I need to talk to you, and I want to tell you what has been happening is not because of my abilities, not because I have learned these skills, not because of what I've done, but I want you to see that God is doing something in our family. I want you to see what God is accomplishing. And I love the fact that when you start reading about this and you start really studying Jacob, you come to the place where you realize that that event at Bethel was not a passing event in his life. It wasn't some night that was just scary for him. It was a night that truly made a difference for him. And God himself, 20 years later, refers to that because Jacob still remembers it. I made a vow to God. And when I made that vow to God, I meant it. And he says, Jacob, I want you to know that I've seen you make that vow, and I've seen you keep it, and I've taken note of what's been happening to you, and I've chosen to give you the things that your father-in-law had. And Jacob, in turn, stands up before his family and says, look what God has done. God has taken care of us. Now, we're going to move to the second group, but let's, on the way there, stop at verse 24. I think a lot of you will remember the story from studying it on Wednesday night, but after Jacob takes his family and his herds and he leaves, and in 7 days, Laban has pretty well caught up with him, and he brought a bunch of their relatives with him. And it would seem that his intent was to take what was Jacob's and take it back with him. We don't know, it doesn't ever say, but that seems like what he's planning to do, to force either Jacob to go back or at least his flocks and his family to go back. But here's what happens. Look at chapter 31, verse 24. And God came to Laban the Syrian, or the Aramean, in a dream by night, and said unto him, take heed that thou speak not to Jacob either good or bad. You know, I don't sense that Laban is at all the same kind of a spiritual character that Jacob is. Laban is instead one who is worshiping other gods. He uses the God of Israel as a god of convenience. He's going to do that at the end of this chapter. He's going to invoke God's name just to put this boundary between him and Jacob. But it's a god of convenience. But can you imagine, as Jacob is lying there at night and all of a sudden, God appears to him and says, Laban, hey, listen up. I'm telling you, when you see Jacob tomorrow, don't you speak good or bad to him. You're not in charge here. Oh, I think that directly confronted Laban's intent. Laban was planning to march into that camp and say, we're going back. Jacob, you go dead or alive, we're going back. And God comes to Laban and says, Laban, I'm in charge, not you. You know, I believe that this is a further testimony to Jacob's family. Because the girls, Leah and Rachel, knew their dad. They knew his temper. There had to be a lot going on in that camp when they realized maybe some spy came in and said, hey, Laban's coming. Laban is only about a day behind us now, and he's got a bunch of guys with him. And those two daughters had to have some sense of, boy, when Dad gets here, he is really going to be upset. I mean, I know Dad's temper. And when Dad gets here, he doesn't like to be crossed. He likes to cross people, but he doesn't like to be deceived. He doesn't like to be crossed himself. And when he gets here, boy, we're gonna pay for this. And perhaps they'd even gone to Jacob and said, Jacob, are you sure that this is going to work out? And Jacob would look at him and say, listen, God told me it was time to go. And I think this is further testimony to his family that when Laban marches into that camp, he doesn't come in with the attitude that he normally comes in with. And he mentions to Jacob, I had a dream. And in this dream, it was clear that it was not your normal dream. It was God speaking to me, and he told me not to mention good or bad, not to tell you what to do, just to come talk to you. And God settled me. God stopped me. And I would imagine that Rachel and Leah would have to go, whew, boy, this isn't what we expected out of Dad. We were expecting him to come in here with guns blazing. And instead, God has stopped him. God has put the brakes on Dad. And his temper is not going to control this time because God has. And I believe that that is the capstone on Jacob's testimony to his family that God can do some things that you don't expect. Let's move to the second group. When we come to chapter 31, let's go all the way down to verse 42. Chapter 42, Laban has come to Jacob's tent and he's searched for his gods. And verse 36, when he doesn't find his gods, it tells us that Jacob is wroth or angry and chode or contended with Laban. He stands up and says, you falsely accused me. And he goes through all the things that he's done. In verse 41, he says, you changed my wages 10 times. Come down to verse 42. And here is what Jacob says to Laban. Except the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had been with me, surely thou hadst sent me away now empty-handed or empty. God hath seen mine affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked thee yesternight. Here is his testimony to his father-in-law. When his father-in-law comes marching into this camp and he's looking for his gods and he doesn't find them, and Jacob doesn't know that his wife actually did steal the gods, Jacob stands up and he boldly confronts his father-in-law and he says, "You have done these things to me. You have acted without integrity before me. You have changed my wages. You've done all of this. And I've done my best to put... I've put forth every effort that I can to make sure your flocks are taken care of. I even took the hit when an animal took those." According to custom, if you were the shepherd and you could bring the remnants of an animal back, it would show that you actually defended that animal even though it killed and you weren't responsible to it. According to Jacob's testimony here, his father-in-law held him responsible for every animal, even if it was attacked in the middle of the night and drug off, even if he had the carcass. He had to take it. He had to pay for that loss. And when Jacob is finished going through that with his father-in-law, he said, "Now I want you to understand that we stand here today and I stand here with something, not empty-handed, because God did it." Well, here's his testimony again. Uncle Laban was a really difficult man to witness to. You would know people like this. He's religious. He's got it all under control. He's in charge. And Jacob finally has the opportunity, and I'm sure that he had talked about God before, but this time in a very clear and direct fashion, he looks at his uncle and he says, "Except the God of my fathers had kept you from doing these things, you would have sent me away empty-handed. And I want you to know that I believe it was the God that rebuked you yesternight or the last night, that God came and He rebuked you on my behalf. And I want you to know that I see God in these things." It's God who's doing it. Before they finish their discussion, you come down to verse 54. And at Laban's suggestion, they build a pillar, and he said, "Let's make an agreement here." And this is an interesting study. Laban doesn't get any of what he wants out of this meeting, but he makes this agreement that they're going to put up this heap of rocks, and he says, "I'm not going to come this way and hurt you, and you don't come this way and hurt me." And they dedicate it to God. But it does tell us that in verse 54, Jacob offered sacrifice upon the mount and called his brethren to eat bread, and they did eat bread and tarried all night in the mount. You know, this sacrifice was probably a thank offering. We don't know the details, but it's probably simply an offering of thanks to God. And in the midst of this difficult time, when Laban is accusing him of all kinds of things, and even in this, Laban tries to cast Jacob as the one who's been deceitful, and he ran away, and he did all these things, and the truth is that Laban is the problem. Jacob doesn't retaliate in that. He just comes to the place where he says, "All right, to tell you what we're going to do. We're going to sacrifice an animal to God tonight as a thank offering." And I love the fact that the testimony to this Uncle Laban, who had been deceitful and who had been difficult to get along with, the final act that he does before he leaves his uncle, and as far as we know, never sees him again, is that he comes before that altar and he says, "I want to sacrifice this animal, recognizing and thanking my God for what He's done for me." That's how I want to leave Uncle Laban. I want him to see me not as one who schemed and plotted to get these things, but one who's looking at heaven and saying, "God gave me these things and you know it." And he gives the glory to God. Who gets the credit in our lives when God does something? I hope it's God. I hope you see the hand of God working in your life as He orchestrates things and He either gives or chooses not to give you something. That it's God's blessing that falls upon you. And Jacob had learned this lesson, and he learned it well, that it was God who was pouring out His blessings on Jacob's life. And Jacob was going to not only recognize those, but he was going to acknowledge God's hand upon him to other people. Well, that takes us to the third group, but we have a little transition that takes place. Go to chapter 32, and I've skipped over these verses as we've read. In chapter 32, after Laban is gone, verse 55 of the chapter 4 says that Laban departed and returned to his place. And then chapter 32, verse 1, "And Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, 'This is God's host,'" or that can be translated God's camp, And he called the name of that place Manaim. The word Manaim means either double camp or place of God's camp. Sometimes it's hard to figure out exactly the meaning, but he named that place the camp of God, the camp of God's angels. And it's the idea that there is a double camp. And what he's inferring by that is that here tonight we have camped and we've had our physical camp. We have had the visible camp here. We've got Jacob and all of his relatives or all of his family and his flocks and his men servants and maid servants, and they're all here. And there's one camp that's very, very visible. But there's another camp that is invisible. And this is not one of the passages that we go to often, but it seems that when they came to this particular place and they went on their way, that God's angels were in essence greeting him. They were standing up saying, "Welcome back." He left. When he got to Bethel, God himself, in the form of a man, met him, or in a dream, met him, and he had to deal with some things. When he comes back to the land, it's as though the host of angels meet him and say, "Welcome home. Good job." And it's a little bit of encouragement that he's going to desperately need in the next few days as he comes in direct contact with his brother Esau. But here is a camp of angels. You know, when you think about that, there's another passage in Scripture, 2 Kings chapter 6, verses 15 through 17. Keep your finger here, but let's turn to that passage. I want to remind you of what we had in this particular passage. 2 Kings chapter 6. During the ministry of Elisha, he has a servant with him that has not experienced and not dealt with things the same way that he has. And the servant of the man of God is there, and to give you the context, they're surrounded by an enemy army. While they've been sleeping, this army has come because they want to kill Elisha because he keeps revealing the plans of the king of Syria to the other to the Israelites. Go to verse 15. Chapter 6, verse 15. "And when the servant of the man of God was risen early and gone forth, behold, an host encompassed the city both with horses and chariots. And his servant said unto him, 'Alas, my master, how shall we do?'" Or, "What are we going to do?" "And Elisha answered, 'Fear not, for they that be with us are more than they that be with them.' And Elisha prayed and said, 'Lord, I pray thee, open his eyes that he may see.' And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha." We seldom get glimpses like this of the other world, as we would call it. But Elisha apparently had the privilege of being able to see how God was working in ways that we don't see. Elisha's here in this city, and the armies of man have surrounded it, and Elisha's completely at peace. And when this servant sees things, he is just really unsettled by what takes place. "What are we going to do?" Naturally, that's what we would do. "How am I going to get out of this?" And Elisha's response is very simply, "You know, there are some things you can't see. I think we're all right. There is a whole host of angels. While they have their horses, God has his angels and horses and his chariots of fire. And we're surrounded. We're as safe as we can ever be when we're in the center of God's will. And here is this protection that is unseen." That seems to be exactly what was taking place when Jacob crossed over and he made his way back from the mountains of Gilead into the promised land. And it says that the angels of God met him. He doesn't elaborate on it. The only thing we have is that he names the place Camp of God, which indicates to us it wasn't just one or two angels, but in some way God opened the eyes of Jacob, and when he came in, he saw a host of angelic beings, and it was to him as though he had his physical camp right here, and God has his camp of angels encircling them. And he said, boy, that's comforting. As I go into some of the situations that I'm about to face, here is a level of comfort knowing that God is present with me. I know I can face these things. And that gives him the courage to give his third testimony. And that testimony is to a brother, literal physical brother, that he has wronged. And while this won't enter into our discussion on Sunday morning, this is probably one of the things that bolsters and encourages him to do some of the things that he has to do. He has just seen visibly the angels of God. They've met him as he's come back into the land. And he recognizes and acknowledges God's hand of blessing on him to his brother. Let's go to chapter 32, verse 10. Verse 10 is where he prays. And in the middle of his prayer, we read this morning, Jacob acknowledges, I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant. For with my staff, or with my staff only, I passed over this Jordan, and now I am large enough that I can divide into two bands or companies of people. So here's Jacob's mindset. It's clear that he knows that God has blessed him abundantly. Now, go to chapter 33. And in chapter 33, Esau comes to him with 400 men. And he's divided, he sent the gifts on in advance, and now he's divided the children unto Leah and Rachel and the two handmaidens, and he puts them behind him. And in verse 3, it says that Jacob passed over before them, passed over ahead of them, and bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near unto his brother. And Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Different outcome than everybody is expecting in this whole thing. But what I want you to see is what Jacob will say, or is going to say, to his brother after that. Look at verse 5. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the women and the children and said, who are these with thee? This is Esau speaking. And Jacob said, the children which God hath graciously given thy servant. Who gets the credit? God. Jacob doesn't come before his brother and say, look what I've done. Look how wonderful I am. Jacob seems to have learned his lesson. Now, he falls back here a little bit, and he still struggles with this. But Jacob has come to a place where he's willing to say, look what God has done for me. Keep going in that passage, and Leah comes, and then he meets all of the family members. Verse 8, Esau asked him a question. He said, what meanest thou by all this drove which I met? And he said, these are to find grace or favor in the sight of my Lord. And Esau said, I have enough, my brother. Keep that thou hast unto thyself. And Jacob said, no, I pray you, or please, if now I have found favor in your sight, then receive my present at my hand. For therefore I have seen thy face as though I had seen the face of God, and thou wast pleased with me, or you have received me favorably. Take, I pray thee, my blessing that is brought to thee, because God hath dealt graciously with me, and because I have plenty. And he urged him, and he took it. And here is Jacob's testimony to his brother. You know, I want to incorporate that into not only his words, but a picture as well. Remember, and let's just read the last verse of chapter 32. Therefore, well, verse 31, let's read that. And as he passed over Peniel, the sun rose upon him, and he halted upon his thigh. That word halted simply means he limped on his thigh. And we'll look at that particular passage next week, but in a wrestling match with God, in order to get him to surrender, God touches the hollow of his thigh, and basically that comes out of joint. And it tells us that when he was finished with that, he's limping. You'll find different ideas as to whether he limped for the rest of his life or whether this was temporary. But there's no question that when he saw the rest of his family, he's walking with a limp, perhaps dragging that leg along a little bit. And it's obvious that he's in pain. If you can imagine having your leg pulled out of joint and then God puts it back in, or you have to put it back in, you're hurting. You're limping. And maybe this had an impact on Esau. As Esau is coming to meet him, Jacob walks out and he's walking out. And what does he do seven times? Do you remember? He bows. Easy thing to do with your hip hurting? Take some effort. And as Esau sees him coming, and he would bow once, and then he would step forward and bow again and come forward and bow again. It wasn't just up and down seven times. It was moving in the direction. It was honoring him as one who was an equal or above him. And all this time, he's limping. And I have to wonder if perhaps God did that to him because Esau would look at him and think, here's my little brother and I think I can take him. Well, now he's limping. You think you can take him? Well, of course you can. You know, it's like a 90-year-old man. I think I can beat you up. Well, I hope so. And here's Jacob now dragging that leg along and coming to his brother. And his brother would have to at some point look at him and say, Jacob, what happened to your leg? Well, I met God. God and I had a talk last night and he whooped up on me a little bit. And this is the evidence of it. Boy, what a testimony. And when he meets his brother, there's a completely different attitude, a completely different testimony than the last time he left his brother. He was leaving his brother last time, and the brother is so angry he's going to kill him. And Jacob is kind of haughty, and he's done this, and he's gotten the blessing, and he's made things work his way. Now there's a completely different attitude. And when Jacob comes back this time, it's who gets the credit? Did Jacob do these things? Nowhere do you find that. You find that God had taken him through those 20 years of learning so that he would finally come to the place where he says, don't look at me, look at God. Because he's done some things far, far beyond what I could ever imagine, what I could ever expect, and he has accomplished more than I could ever tell you. And he points toward God. You know, I believe that's what God is wanting us to do. Some of us don't have a whole lot. Some have more than others. But God's intent is for us to always be pointing to Him, to always be giving Him the glory and the credit for the things that happen in our lives. And as we go through different circumstances, different scenarios, it is always an opportunity for us simply to point to heaven and say, look what God has done. Look what God is accomplishing in my life. It is amazing. And I don't want you to see me. I want you to see God. And you and I need to learn that lesson that we have to proclaim to others that it is God who is working in our lives. It's God who's accomplishing things that I can't accomplish. What a joy it is to be able to look at this passage and see that 20 years before, this man had been in a church service by himself. And he had come into contact with God. And the result was that he bowed before God and he said, God, if you do these things, you're definitely my God. I'm going to surrender to you. I'm going to let you do these things. And 20 years later, he's holding to that. He's obviously changed to the point where people are looking at him and they're thinking, wow, this guy is different. Why is he different? Well, I can tell you why. Because he said, God did it. God changed me. That's what people need to hear from us. That God is why I'm different. God is the one who's given me what I have, and God is the one who's done everything that's been accomplished in my life. And tonight I want you to simply walk away saying that that's what I want people to see from me. That I have a testimony that God is working in my life. And I want to give that testimony to the people around me. Jacob did it to his immediate family. He did it to his uncle Laban. And he did it in front of his brother. Somebody that was difficult for him to do it in front of. But he did it. He said, God is the one that I want you to see in this, not me. Let's bow for prayer, please.